Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. It isn't just for sailors and bikers anymore, but then it wasn't always for them in the past. Tattooing, that is. And that's the subject of this week's conversation between Talking History's Eileen Dugan and Margot DeMello. But before we get to that interesting subject, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. This week in 1942, American and Philippine defenders on Bataan surrendered to Japanese forces during the height of Japanese military success in the early stages of the Asia-Pacific conflict of World War II. Bataan, a peninsula at the southwest tip of the Filipino island of Luzon, was the last refuge for 12,500 U.S. service personnel, 26,000 civilians, and 67,000 Filipino troops after Japanese forces landed on the island in December 1941. General Douglas MacArthur, the U.S. commander, ordered the withdrawal to the peninsula on December 24th. For 3 months, the defenders held on, and at one point the Japanese offensive was halted. But the defenders' ranks were plagued with malnutrition and disease. Help was not forthcoming, and by April, American and Filipino forces were smashed. MacArthur, who had been ordered by President Roosevelt to withdraw to Australia, ordered Commanding General Jonathan Wainwright not to surrender. However, in order to prevent needless slaughter, Wainwright's ground commander, General Edward King, surrendered to Japanese forces on April 9, 1942. 78,000 of Bataan's weary, malnourished, and disease-stricken defenders were herded out of the peninsula in what became known as the Bataan Death March. Forced to march 65 miles while being clubbed, beaten, and bayoneted along the way, at least 10,000 died before they completed the march. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a murder, a mystery, and a marriage is not the latest story from Danielle Steele or Michael Crichton, but rather it is the nearly forgotten story by Mark Twain that will be published in Atlantic Monthly in July. Retrieved from oblivion in 1995, Twain's short story was written in 1876, just after he wrote The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, and it has never been available to the reading public until now. The story involves a father who wants his daughter to marry the son of the wealthiest man in their rural Missouri town, but then a stranger comes to town. How the story concludes is for you to find out, but it will be entertaining. The story will be published in book form in September. Leo Tolstoy, the great figure of Russian literature and author of War and Peace, is probably rolling over in his grave in response to his great-great-grandson's attempt to reconcile him with the Russian Orthodox Church. But Vladimir Tolstoy insists that his famous ancestor ought to be forgiven in the name of national reconciliation. Over 100 years ago, Leo Tolstoy rejected the authority of the Orthodox Church and developed his own version of Christianity. At his death in 1910, he refused to repent for his heretical deeds that had resulted in his excommunication from the church in 1901. 100 years later, Vladimir has requested that the church reconsider its 1901 excommunication decision. This is Talking History. Has your daughter added one? Perhaps you're considering one. If so, you're in good company, historically speaking, as tattoos have been a prominent part of body art for centuries. Here to explore that history with you is Talking History's Eileen Dugan.
The world of tattooing has undergone an astonishing transformation in recent years. Once considered the province of sailors, bikers, and society's misfits, tattoos now quite visibly adorn the bodies of sports heroes, movie stars, and Wall Street brokers. Tattoos, in short, have gone upscale. How did this happen? What has happened within tattoo culture and in American society to make it so appealing to the middle and upper classes? With us today to discuss the rise of the modern tattoo community is Dr. Margot DeMello, author of a number of scholarly works on tattoo culture, including the recent monograph, Bodies of Inscription, A Cultural History of the Modern Tattoo Community. Welcome, Dr. DeMello.
Thank you.
How did tattooing get introduced to the West in the first place?
It was introduced through sailors, British sailors that accompanied the explorers like Captain Cook, primarily Captain Cook, to the Pacific Islands in the 17th century. When Captain Cook, quote-unquote, discovered Polynesia, and some of the other Polynesian islands, his sailors were very, very interested in the practice of tattooing that they witnessed among the native people. What's very interesting about how they physically brought tattooing back to the Western world is they did so through a number of means. The ship's artists would draw the native people with the designs on their bodies. The sailors actually got tattoos by the Polynesians, so they brought tattoos back on their own bodies. And then on slightly later trips, they brought back captive Polynesians to display in the Western world with those tattoos.
And how did tattooing come to the United States then?
The same means, through sailors. So you had a lot of cross currents between the Europeans and the Americans through immigration from Europe to the Americas. During the Civil War, you had soldiers on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line getting tattoos. So it really passed through military lines from Europe to the Americas.
And besides the military, who else were the first tattoo enthusiasts in this country?
In this country, you had your military men, you had your circus and carnival people. This was directly from Polynesia, as those early explorers brought back native tattooed people, primarily men from the islands. They displayed them in these traveling shows. They were ten-in-ones, they were dime museums, and they were carnivals, and they displayed them and traveled with them. That later translated into Europeans and then later Americans themselves getting tattooed, making up very elaborate tales of how they were captured by native people, by either American Indians or by Polynesian societies, forcibly tattooed, and then, of course, these are made-up tales, and then they put themselves on display as well, and then they traveled around the world showing their elaborate tattoos for money. So you had the sailors, you had the circus and carnival circuit, and then you had a fairly brief time around the turn of the 19th century, you also had the upper classes in both Europe and America getting very small tattoos as status symbols.
What images did these first tattoo fanciers wear?
Some were borrowed, at the very, very earliest, were borrowed directly, again, from the people that they took tattooing from the Tahitians and the other Polynesians. But very quickly, they became associated with military symbols, with Navy and then later Army and Marine symbols. There was a lot of symbols about mother. You had name tattoos were popular from the very, very earliest times. Some of the earliest tattooists, professional tattooists in this country, were actually sign painters by trade, and they took their sign painting skills and shifted that over into tattooing. So again, a lot of the tattoos were signs, essentially. They were signs of love for the mother or for their loved ones. They were in commemoration of a certain event, like a historic battle. They were real sort of nostalgic kinds of images. A little bit later, cartoons that were popular in the early part of the century, they made it into tattoos. They're essentially sort of a chronology of popular culture
and
on the body.
And in a way, they're very literal, too, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Those early tattoos were extremely literal. There was no interpretation. There was no having to wonder what a particular image meant, because if it didn't have a word on it saying exactly what it meant, it was very clear. It's a tombstone. It's a ship. It's an eagle. It's a garland. They were very, very literal.
And were women tattooed in the early 20th century and before?
Very, very infrequently. You mostly saw that, again, in the circus and carnival circuit. Women at that time were not typically independent. They didn't have their own jobs, their own careers, their own ways of making money and being independent from men. So there were a few very, very independent women who decided to make a living for themselves, and they saw it as an easy way to make a living. You typically paid $100 or $200 perhaps to have your whole body tattooed. At the beginning, you didn't have to have your whole body tattooed because the decorum of the early century didn't allow for, say, upper thighs to be shown. So you'd pay a tattooist to tattoo your whole body or as much can be shown, and then that would be it for your life. You'd basically travel around, usually during the summer months. You'd travel around with the circus or the carnival, and then you'd maybe, have the winter months off, and then you could pursue your other interests, and you'd have a fairly decent living for a single woman at that time. Some of the women were also wives of tattooists, and so it was a husband-wife team.
How did tattooing come to be associated with the working class and with those on the margins of society, like bikers and criminals and such?
Well, it started with the military, and It was primarily through the military and primarily through the circus people, you know, neither of which population was terribly educated. And then after World War II, you had a number of changes in society, including the rise of a very strong middle class, the rise of the suburbs, the rise of a lot of white-collar jobs that didn't exist before. And at that time, you had different subcultural populations developing at the same time. Bikers developed pretty much, again, straight out of World War II. They were sort of disaffected Air Force men who came back and weren't happy with a little bit of what they found when they came back to American society. They found that tattoos were a way to sort of express their rebellious nature. As the middle class sort of started to take over a little bit in the society and the military men who were really patriotic figures, they started to lose a little bit of their positive status in the society. World War II was really the last good war that we fought. So the military didn't have such positive connotations afterwards, so the fact that they were wearing tattoos and continued to wear tattoos, that gave it a little bit of a negative stigma. You had then the bikers who started with the tattoos. You also had separate parallel movements within other marginal populations in society, like Chicanos, like convicts, other people like that. Convicts, for instance, had been getting tattooed for the past at least 150, 200 years in Europe and then later in the United States. So all of these different populations, all of whom were experimenting with tattoos, sort of combined to make tattoos really quite unsavory for the middle and upper classes.
And what kinds of tattoos did these people have?
It depended a little bit on the population. You had part of it depended on the technology, actually. So within prison, they didn't have access to tattoo machines. The tattoo machine had been developed at the end of the 19th century. It was based on the mechanical pen, and that was something that you needed to have electricity to do, which they didn't have in prison. So they had to pretty much hand scratch the tattoos in the beginning, pen and ink. Later, and today, they do have actually quite elaborate illegal machines in prison that they make out of radio parts and electric shavers and things like that. But back then, they could basically do it with needle and ink. So the style you would get would be defined by that. They were very thin lines. They didn't have multiple needles the way that the modern machines have the capability to have anywhere up to, you know, 15 needles going in at once. So the lines were very thin. They were black only because they only had the black India ink available to them. They didn't have other colors available. And then again, the iconography was associated with prison life now. So we've got images associated with justice or injustice. You have, depending on the ethnicity of the population, so the Chicano populations would have a lot of Christian imagery, a lot of Catholic, Jesus and the Virgin Mary and that kind of thing. But they had a really, really distinctive look that was radically different from what was going on outside of the prison. And then at the same time, bikers, some of them would move in and out of prison. They'd take that technology, they'd take those images and designs outside with them, and some of the Chicano gangsters would do the same thing, and so you had crossover into both of those populations on the outside.
How would you describe a tattoo parlor before, say, the 1980s?
Having never been in one myself before the 80s, but having interviewed loads of people who either ran them or were getting tattooed back then, they were a fairly unsavory affair in the, say, the 50s and the 60s and the 40s. They were placed primarily for men that men would go to. There was basically no hygiene whatsoever, so you might clean, if you did clean, rinse off your needle before between customers, you would do it in, say, a bucket of Lysol water. There were a lot of men who would just simply hang out, and they talk, and they talk about women, and they talk about sex. It was a sort of a community. It was a place where a community would sort of be formed among a lot of these men. You could go in. A lot of these places were open 24 hours a day, so you could go any time of the day or night. The tattoos were cheap. They were quick. You just would pick something off of the wall. You'd pick flash off of the wall, depending on your mood. Some tattooists offered a very, very limited selection of designs, and you only got what they had on their wall. Or one tattooist was known to only offer a certain image on a particular day. So today it might be roses, and that's all he's going to do today is roses. It was very, very different from the artist-type studio that you go into today.
And in time, a more oriental style also came into tattooing, didn't it?
Right, and there again, you've got the military influence. Japan independently had a very, very long tradition of tattooing in Japan that had a real artistic origin in terms of some of the wood cuttings. They would use some of the designs and the imagery from some of the, not ancient, but the early wood cuts. And so they were beautiful, beautiful designs that the Japanese people would put on themselves. Now, on the other hand, you had sailors again traveling to Japan and sailors traveling to Hong Kong as well, and there would be tattoo studios specifically set up for the sailors to bring images back. China didn't have a big tradition of tattooing among their own people, but they did produce tattoos for Europeans and for Americans. So you had a different type of tattoo that would then again travel on those American and European bodies back over here and ultimately radically changed what we do here. One of the biggest changes that it made was that Japanese in particular used the whole body or big parts of the body in their design. So you had full back pieces, full chest pieces, full torsos, full arms, full sleeves, whereas here it had always been individual tattoos put on the body in sort of as little badges, little individual images that often had no association with one another, even with the heavily, heavily tattooed circus people who basically they did have their whole bodies covered. You could count hundreds of individual designs on those bodies as opposed to a Japanese person with a full bodysuit who would have perhaps one, you know, primary image covering his whole body.
When did tattooing become popular among the middle class?
That started in the 70s, but really, really took off in the 1980s, and it had to do with a number of different social movements that were happening at the same time in American society and to a lesser extent around the world. You had feminism, you had environmentalism, you had the gay-lesbian movements just starting out. You had New Age and the self-help movements. All of these different movements had in common with them some elements that ended up being incorporated into tattooing and that ended up really fitting well with tattooing once it was sort of pulled out of its traditional working class context. One thing that I've noticed about those movements is they're very strongly narrative-based. They're about stories, a lot of them. There was a lot of self-help and New Age in particular. You've got people telling these elaborate stories about themselves and their path, their spiritual path and their emotional path and that kind of thing. And a lot of that fit really perfectly in with something like tattooing, which is visual, it's symbolic. It also can be used to tell stories. It had always tattoos, as literal as they used to be, they were stories. They were, oh, here I got this tattoo when I was at when I was in Hong Kong during my, you know, 1955 tour of duty, and I got this pig on the back of my thigh because it means this, and this rooster means this. So again, they were stories. Later, as the middle class started to use tattooing, they brought them into their personal stories about their lives and their evolving selves. And they could, you know, sometimes they start out very simple. You might have the same butterfly that you know, somebody would pull off of a wall in a tattoo studio 20 years before, but maybe you invest that butterfly with all kinds of meaning. I've got a butterfly on me because I am transforming right now from my old self to my new self, and the butterfly represents, you know, the moving from the caterpillar to the beautiful new, you know, animal that flies in freedom. And you can invest such a simple little design with so much meaning. And that's what really I think the middle class did, was they were looking for ways to invest their lives with meaning and to talk about that and to show that and to symbolize that. And tattoos ended up being, as different as the populations who wore them were, they ended up being really a perfect vehicle for this new way of self-awareness and self-discussion.
Very, very briefly, what do you think is the future of tattooing in the tattoo community?
I think it's all over the board. I think it's going to continue to grow. I think it's going to continue to spread into different populations. I think you're going to see more changes in the way that they look and also the way that they're used as different populations get involved in tattooing and use them for different means. Because again, on the one hand, it's just a design on skin. That's all it is. But how it is invested and how meaning is injected into that tattoo by its wearer is really what it's all about. That's where the meaning is. And so as different populations are using them in totally different new communities and new ways of life that are being developed, I mean, here now in the 21st century with all of the dot-coms and all the people who were involved in all the computer world, you're seeing different, again, kinds of designs coming out and just different ways of expressing, different ways that people can express themselves through tattoos. You're also seeing, I think, more differences. One of the things that happened with the middle class coming in and with artists getting involved, with the Asian influence, with all these things, it really cemented the difference between the old working class styles of tattooing and then some of the new middle class styles, and I think that continues to happen as unfortunately our society becomes more and more differentiated by class and by all different cultural trappings. Tattoos express that. They show that as well as they become differentiated into different groups.
Well, thank you, Dr. DeMello.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Margot DeMello, author of Bodies of Inscription, A Cultural History of the Modern Tattoo Community.
Despite everything you just heard about the history of tattoos, as body art employed even by the wealthy and well-born, tattoos have long suffered from the reputation of being the sign of the disreputable. Jane Kaplan takes on that subject in our op-ed of the week. Kaplan is the Marjorie Walter Goodhart Professor of European History at Bryn Mawr College. She's also the editor of Written on the Body, That Tattoo in European and American History, published last year by Princeton University Press.
How come tattoos have had such a bad reputation until recently? And do they really deserve it? When I decided to investigate the history of the tattoo in 19th century Europe, I found out why they got their notorious association with criminals and lowlife. But I also found some unexpected sides to the story. We know more than you might think about tattooed Europeans 150 years ago, even though they are no longer around to show us their tattoos. The reason for this is that some of their contemporaries were interested enough to study people with tattoos, and we can still read what they wrote on the subject. But these writers were mainly police experts and criminologists. Their agenda was crime control. The tattoos they chose to look at were on criminals, and the story they wanted to tell about them was this. Tattooing, they said, was a primitive practice that had long ago died out in Europe as Christian civilization advanced. But in the 18th century, European sailors, unfortunately, rediscovered the tattoo among Pacific Islanders and brought this exotic art back home. It spread among lower-class people who knew no better, and it became especially popular among unsettled and marginal types, soldiers, sailors, criminals, prostitutes, people who really didn't belong to respectable society. Some experts argue that all tattooed people were what we would now call congenital criminals, and that their tattoos were signs of their innately degenerate character. Others didn't go quite that far, but they still described tattoos as primitive and disgraceful. These views helped to lock into place the image of the tattoo as a shameful scar that has no place on civilized men and women. But by looking into this history a bit further, you can find intriguing twists that unsettle this inherited image. Tantalizing fragments of evidence suggest that tattooing has been far more at home in European history than we might think. For example, Christian pilgrims to the Holy Land and some other shrines got themselves tattooed with Christian symbols. The boatmen who rowed tourists around the Bay of Naples in the 18th century also sported pious tattoos of crosses and saints. Working men in Europe might declare their pride in their trade with tattoos of its traditional emblems, a hammer and anvil for a smith, for example, or woodworking tools for a carpenter. And in Victorian Britain, tattooing was so popular in the army and navy that it broke through the class barrier. It was quite common for officers to be tattooed, often with the badge of their regiment. Some people hinted that in England, the judge who pronounced sentence was almost as likely to be tattooed as the criminal who faced him in the dock. This kind of evidence suggests that the tattoo can claim to have been part of Europe's heritage for many centuries, and that it reflected many sides of cultural and social life. The tattoo may sit on the surface of our skin, but its history, it seems, lies deeper.
You've been listening to Jane Kaplan, Marjorie Walter Goodhart Professor of European History at Bryn Mawr College and the editor of Written on the Body, The Tattoo in European and American History. This is Talking History. Circus people certainly sported tattoos, so maybe it isn't too much of a stretch for us to recommend to you this week a museum that brings circus history to life. Here to tell you about that museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Circus World Museum in Baraboo, Wisconsin, brings 200 years of circus history to life. Here you can learn about the first circus in 1793 on up to the present, and you'll find a wonderful collection of circus wagons, posters, films, and other rare pieces of circus memorabilia. And from May to mid-September, it becomes a living museum with exceptional circus acts under a canvas big top, parades of wagons and animals, clowns, and much more. And each July, the Great Circus Parade takes place on the streets of Milwaukee with a spectacular two-hour recreation of the old-time street processionals the traveling shows used to use to announce their arrival in town. The Circus World Museum is a fun and fascinating look at the history of entertainment.
We have three world premieres to call to your attention this week, all to be aired on the History Channel. On April 22nd, Mutiny, The Hunt for Red October will tell the story of the 1975 failed mutiny aboard the Russian destroyer Red October. The mutiny, by the way, was not an attempt to defect to the West, as later popularized in novel and film, but rather an attempted coup to topple Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev. On April 25th, in Buried Treasure, the History Channel will update you on gold, silver, and other riches still hidden around the world, from the darkest caves to the deepest depths of the oceans. And on April 29th, watch for Mystery of the 364th, where over 1,000 members of the all-black infantry killed by the U.S. Army for threatening military morale during World War II, oral history, eyewitness accounts, and rumors have coalesced into what some believe is one of the darkest chapters in American military history. But if fact and fiction blended into one of history's most exaggerated legends, tune in and make up your own mind. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact show times of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.